everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail! Hey, over there!
Loud mail, evidently.
My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. And happy Thanksgiving, William.
Yeah, if you're in the U.S. or you just really like Thanksgiving, happy Thanksgiving. Hope you had a good one.
Great time for families to gather and overeat, and that's kind of it now.
Yeah, it's basically an excuse for a really long weekend, which we took.
Mm-hmm. We took a few days off.
Yeah,
we're a couple
of podcasts short this week, but we wanted to make sure we put in a mailbag episode because we love y'all, and some of our Patreon episodes are going up, so head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork for that. But this is our mail show. This is your show, and it's a show we hate to, like... If we're not going to do a show, we don't want this to be the show. This is your show. So here's how the show works. You send us a letter.
And we answer it.
Pretty much.
And that's how it works.
You send us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Or you can send us something in an actual mail box. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Send an actual mail envelope, they're called. Ooh. A mailbox. It's a little
But it goes inside the mon. It goes inside our mailbox.
We have a P.O. box, a post office box. Write it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And we don't like to dilly-dally, because this is, again, your show. So, Whitney, why don't you just hop on in there.
Read an email. Hot tub of letters. This is a letter from Lauren R. Hello, Lauren.
Hi, Lauren.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, let's just get to the point.
Uh-oh.
Okay. I didn't like Halloween Kills.
Okay.
Sorry, Bibbs, I was totally on Whitney's side for that review. Good ideas, big fucking mess.
I can live with that.
While I'm under 30, Halloween is one of those series that I treat the same vein that someone might treat Star Trek or Lord of the Rings. I watched Halloween at a very influential age, and I've come to know and care way too much about it and could bore someone to tears with my opinions and trivial knowledge about the series as a whole. Rather getting into the weeds, one of the issues I had with Halloween Kills was the reliance on references not only to the original film, but to the sequels, which do not exist in this continuity. And this in turn factors into a bigger issue with movie franchises as of late, with Star Wars arguably one of the worst offenders, the pandering of nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
As we come up on a new Ghostbusters, it came out by the time we got read this letter, this is bringing up once again the moaning and groaning on both sides because online film discourse only deals in absolutes, and it's exhausting. For me personally, I feel like an overabundance of references can weaken the quality of a movie because not only does it take me out of the film, it tells me that the filmmakers really aren't trusting the audience to enjoy a different and new approach to the material. But what I'm curious about at this point is the knee-jerk reactions either to immediately dismiss or encourage nostalgia pandering and how often it is rife and condescending to the other side. If nostalgia is the only thing motivating the plot, then is it a movie worth celebrating? I understand wanting to support filmmakers in general, but at what point do we allow ourselves to concede to fatigue and exhaustion with franchises that we love? I could give a damn about seeing another Star Wars movie, and I was evil dies tonighted to death out of caring what is going to happen in the next Halloween film, but I will watch it because that's the horse and wagon I got on when I was 12 and I'm stuck with it.
Look, they're all like 90 minutes long. You might as well at that point. What else is on TV?
I'm the sucker for hitching his wagon to Star Trek because there's so much of it now.
Yeah.
And so much of it is bad.
Yeah.
And yet I'm still, like, that's the one I still kind of feel obligated to keep following. It's like, well, I need to
I don't know if
see
there's
what's
anything
going on.
There's nothing I feel obligated to keep following, but I watch so much bad shit anyway. It's like, well, I might as well watch the next entry in this bad horror franchise. I've seen the rest of them.
Yeah,
I have to review them anyway.
I've seen the other two Thanksgiving movies.
Oh,
why not?
God.
Oh, because I've seen Thanksgiving.
I've only seen the first Thanksgiving, and it was rough going.
Yeah, it's really, really bad. And I did not see the sequel, Thanksgiving 3. There's no Thanksgiving 2.
That's the joke.
I think that's a good joke.
It's an okay joke.
I'll give them that.
It's not a ha-ha joke.
So many sequels get lost in sort of the vast jumble of sequels. It's okay that they pretended like they lost one.
Mm. Anyway, back to the way.
Lauren says, so is there a point for us as film fans to let our beloved franchises go, Lauren R.? We've been talking about this a lot recently. I feel like we're at a reckoning with a lot of popular culture right now.
I think what's happened is there's a lot of people... so much of the media and advertising and discourse around those two things are catered at a certain demographic, an age demographic of fans. People in their teens, 20s, maybe early 30s, but that's generally the vibe. where these movies are trying to sort of congeal around. And
I've said before, 11 to 17 is kind of like the prime spot.
I think that's expanded to the 20s, but regardless, there reaches a point where you have been avidly consuming the same thing over and over and over again, and it before you realize it, it's been decades.
Mm.
And you can hit critical mass on that. It's only reasonable. It's people act like it's unreasonable to say, like, oh, I'm going to give up on Star Wars. It's fine. You don't have to do that. You can always come back if you want. It's going to be here. There's plenty around.
There's that thing where if you are really vocal about your fandom and you buy, and, you know, there's...
You might have to eat a little crow if you give it up. But, like, yeah,
there's a when it comes to being a fan of something and... I know there's been a recent push to redefine fan as being just liking something, but that's not what a fan is. That's just liking something.
Yeah, fan is short for fanatic.
Fanatic. So in order to be a fanatic, you have to kind of be a little bit demonstrative about that, don't you? You have to bring it up a lot, perhaps.
At least on a shirt.
You have to
This sounds like gatekeeping.
I'm not trying to gatekeep or say, like, who's a true fan and who isn't, but I am saying there is a distinction between someone who just enjoys something casually versus somebody who devotes a portion of their life to it. And I know a big part of that is expressing yourself, whether it's an online forum or meeting other people or going to a convention. There's always a financial aspect to it. You have to buy something. You have to sort of buy a t-shirt or buy a knickknack or, you know, even if you're just buying the video itself.
Or just buying the tickets for the video game or whatever the hell
like,
it is.
There's going to be some sort of financial transaction to fandom.
It's the world in which we live. Unless what you're a fan of is the public domain.
Well, I mean, you could be a Sherlock Holmes nerd, but, you know.
If you're keeping up with the new stuff, you have to pay for it. But I'm talking about exclusively public domain. Like,
ooh, I'd love, if you're a public domain nerd, I want to meet you.
Yeah.
I'm a big, who's in the public domain right now besides Sherlock Holmes? Dracula fan. Yeah, I'm a big Modesty Blaze fan.
Yeah.
I'm a good big Horatio Hornblower fan. Yeah, it can get really, really exhausting from just how performative you need to be to keep up with that. It's not now when if you're a fan and you're sort of like gathering the videos around yourself and you're writing essays and exploring art and delving into film theory and using fandom as sort of the structure on which you build a greater appreciation for other arts or use it as a way to develop the vocabulary of criticism, so you can apply it to other arts that you encounter.
At that point, you're a fan of criticism. I think it's all different.
Well, at that point, you're just sort of growing in your ability to engage in discourse.
Right. I feel like what we're talking about here with this email, though, specifically, because you're right, we have talked about, a lot of people have been emailing us, and it feels like a lot of people want to know if it's okay to just give up.
It totally is. If you're looking for permission, you have our permission.
Yeah, regardless of whether whoever you're listening,
you don't need our
listening.
Permission, but you have it.
So, but I feel like there's a lot of peer pressure when it comes to this is what we talk about, this is what we're into, and if you leave, what are you gonna talk about with these people? Mm-hmm. So I get that, but specifically, this emailist I think is talking about how nostalgia and the way that ongoing franchises try to capitalize on and end up wallowing in nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
Accelerates our willingness to drop it.
Yeah.
Because after a while, like, yeah, I like the old thing. I don't need new things to remind me of it. Those things are readily available.
Mm.
It's not like I can't get John Carpenter's Halloween on home video. Like, I can get that at any time. So I don't need you to remind me of that constantly in your new movie. It's more exciting to move on. The occasional reference to what came before can sometimes just make perfect sense plot-wise, because it takes place in a continuity of some sort. Halloween is weird in that regard, but each of them takes place in some kind of continuity.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing a lot of is this idea that by pandering to nostalgia, specifically pandering, and filling your movie with endless references to things that you knew before. So you can go, hey!
Snap your finger and point and say, that's something I know.
Yeah, or the Captain America line from Avengers. I understood that reference.
Yeah, there you go.
And that really is a lot of Ghostbusters Afterlife. Like, a surprising amount of Ghostbusters Afterlife. That's very easily going to hit a critical mass of, at that point, you're really not doing anything new. And I think that's true for Ghostbusters Afterlife. A movie I don't dislike watching, but I think adds nothing new to it.
No,
it's just, hey, remember this? Yes, you got these new actors. Yeah, they're going to do anything new? Old stuff. Oh.
It's not just that they're repeating it. It's that they are, it's lazy storytelling because they're trying to grandfather in your affection for the previous thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that you recognize it. It's that you're going to feel a certain way about it.
Yeah.
What if you saw the original Ghostbusters and you don't like that movie or you don't have a deep affection for that movie? All of these references are things you might recognize.
Yeah.
But you're not like going to be really moved by the appearance of some of those things at the end.
I feel like what they're trying to do is for people who are less familiar with Ghostbusters, maybe the young people in the audience who are going because of the young cast, for example, or being dragged by their parents, just as likely. They're trying to use that nostalgia to vaunt, to idolize previous entries in the franchise so that young people will start consuming the old stuff and revere it the way that their parents want them to.
So
and that's why I find Afterlife especially cynical.
Yeah, it serves as a commercial for the thing that came before it.
I don't think Halloween Kills is specifically doing that, but it is a weird scenario, and you're 100% right about this. The two David Gordon Green Halloween movies, the first one less so than the second, take a lot of their cues from the movies that they allegedly wanted to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
And even up until, like, the end of the last one, I mean, I would not be shocked if the next one, it just goes full-blown Supernatural at this point. Like, because, like, they leave that as, like, part of, like... And this leads me to my weird fan theory about this Halloween movie, which I will say again.
Go for it.
My headcanon for this is the reason why this is so similar to the way a lot of other Halloween sequels worked out. Is because there is one root chronology in Halloween, and then at some point the Cult of Thorn went back in time and splintered it into multiple realities.
So it's like a Star Trek 2009 scenario.
Yeah, like it was bound to go kind of the same way, which is why Rob Zombie's Halloween 2 kind of follows the plot of like Halloween 4, 5, and 6 a little bit.
Yeah.
And then we see David Gordon Green's first Halloween, which is basically Halloween H2O.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see Halloween Kills, which has a lot of elements from Halloween 2.
Well, Halloween 4.
Halloween
especially,
4, especially. A lot of. And I actually like Halloween 4 originally. But regardless, I feel like we want to try to move away, but either we're afraid to or. It's all a conspiracy.
It's all this, like, fatalistic story.
And we're going to find out at the end. It's all a twist. And there's going to be, like, three Jamie Lee Curtises.
And
it's going to be
three
great.
Michaels will all fight each other. Sure. They'll just stab each other and none of them will die. And they'll just be locked in a room stabbing each other for all eternity.
There was this thing where it's like, we're going to make Halloween better by making it more serious. We've done that multiple times.
Make it weirder.
That's what I want.
Apart from Halloween 3, it was never like a wacky series. And Halloween
6 was bizarre.
Six is just
six
awful,
is fucking weird. Was it Resurrection?
That's part 8. Yeah,
Resurrection.
The one with
eight.
Busta Rhymes.
That one's stupid.
That one's pretty stupid too. Yeah. Here's my theory about sort of the reason we've gotten, and surely everybody has noticed this acceleration of nostalgia based sequels and remakes and what have you. It was especially apparent in the early 2010s when all the horror movies were getting remade.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still continuing.
More the late 2000s.
Late 2000s. Yeah, I guess
that's
like
when we started getting Texas Chainsaw.
Around there, yeah. There were a lot of these horror remakes going on for a while. It was a big trend. And
it was right after the J-horror boom. Yeah.
There's, I think this has a lot to do with accessibility to certain home media, right?
Yeah.
Back before the inception of the VCR, you could only see a film once every couple of years, maybe, as it came through your town.
So nostalgia would be actual nostalgia, which is, I remember. I haven't seen that in a while.
I've seen this movie 4 times. Wow, you're insane. 4 times? Nobody sees movies 4 times.
Yeah.
Home video accelerated that. Yeah. Now you could stay at home and you could watch Star Wars repeatedly all day long. Yeah. And you could attach yourself to certain details. Yeah. And I've said this before, it's like you're hooked on heroin and you're growing like an immunity to it. Let's not say heroin. Let's say caffeine.
let's scale that shit back a smidge.
You drink a lot of caffeine, you build up sort of a resistance to it, right? You have to drink more and more to get the same kind of buzz. After a while, you're drinking all this caffeine, that is, you're watching the original Star Wars over and over again and you're feeling nothing. So you need the same drink cut with something new. You need now you need espresso. You need a stronger coffee. So it's still coffee, but it's the same flavor, but it's just more powerful. And that's what a remake does. It gives you the same buzz in a new package.
I can see that.
And I think with streaming an online discourse now, that's accelerated even further. Yeah. Because we're not just rewatching the movies. Now we're discussing and dissecting every detail more and more.
And that's the other thing
to
I
the
think
point
is
where everything falls apart really fast and we need to go real hard to get that high again.
It's important to remember also that this whole nostalgia thing, the whole like revisiting popular movies of yore and just sort of repackaging them or doing them as a TV series now, that goes back over half a century. Mm. Hollywood had been doing that since the silent era. Hollywood was doing that in the sound era. Once TV started coming along, we started getting TV series based on popular movies, popular movie stars and things. And,
well, and even in the era of radio, there's like radio, there's a series version of The Third Man.
Of course there is.
The Adventures of Harry Lyme.
Yeah, which is weird.
He
was the fucking villain in the first one. What the hell?
But like, he turns into kind of a hero in the show.
I know, it's super weird. But like, my point is that they do this constantly, but it's accelerated now. It's, If you ever see the movie Mimic, there's a good explanation of the movie Mimic. Mimic is a story about there's a disease spread by
cockroaches.
Well, cockroaches. It's spread by cockroaches in New York City, and it's killing all the children in New York City. And so what they do is they come up with a new breed of cockroach that eats all those other cockroaches. Great. Problem solved. It works. 10 years later, cockroaches breed fast. And so we are thousands upon thousands of generations from that mutant strain being released in the sewers.
And they adapt a lot faster than regular cockroaches.
And now they're the size of human beings. And the thing is that it's not 10 years, it's thousands of generations. Mm. That's what you got to focus on. Not the amount of time, but the amount of cycles.
Yeah, so,
and pop culture, thanks largely to social media, thanks in big part to the increased availability of media where people can revisit things constantly. We're going through the cycles faster and faster and faster, and the same sort of delivery system or same dosage of nostalgia doesn't hit the same way.
Mm-hmm. So we need stronger and stronger doses. So
or weaker. We're demanding weaker. It's too much for us. Mm-hmm. We want to quit, and so we do.
Yeah. What you're saying is pop culture is a mutant cockroach.
Yes, I am. I chose that. Yeah. That is not a joke. That is,
no,
yes.
That's completely apt, that the cycles go faster and faster and faster, it's too much to keep up with.
Yes, it is.
And we don't want to eat the same regurgitation every time.
No, we want something new once in a while, and then we want to copies of that for a while.
Let's go on to another letter.
Let's do it.
All right, here's a letter from Dr. Nova. Hello, Dr. Nova.
Hey, Dr. Nova.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, I love books. As such, the possibility of reading everything is impossible.
Yep.
That's true. So here's my advice for film fans. There's this thing called mood reading, which is just following what you're in the mood for rather than the movie or book you have to see or read, because it's either a classic or Marvel. Also, if there's something you want to not watch, don't. Hmm. For example, I will never watch Brokeback Mountain.
Okay.
Because when boring people found out I'm queer and a film fan, they said, oh, have you seen Brokeback Mountain? So no, I will never see it. Fuck those people. Dr. Nova. I think that's legit. That's fine.
If the movie reminds you of something annoying, you never have to see that thing. You might choose one day to see it and maybe you'll like it, but you also could go your whole life without seeing it and you'll be fine. We've been talking about this for a few episodes now. People have written in about, they're young and they're just getting started, catching up on classic cinema, cult cinema, whatever they're into. But there's over 100 years of film history to catch up on. And it's daunting. And you don't know where to start. And you don't know, how you can possibly fit it all in. Because you're
FOMO pretty fast.
Because you're eager and you want to. And that's great. That's wonderful that you're so passionate about it. That you want to, see all these allegedly classic movies and every film from your favorite filmmakers and discover new things. And that's great. You'll get to it. If you want to, you'll get to it. You don't need to stress yourself out. If you want to come up with a plan, I'm going to see every David Lynch movie in the next 6 months. You can do that. But you also can just follow your bliss and go right ahead and do that. That's totally fine.
And I encouraged that because I'm not sure if I was very articulate about it, but I wanted everybody's sort of personal stock of movies, the list of things they've seen. Mm-hmm. I wanted every list to be different. I want everybody to sort of explore their own interests in a way, because if you're exploring something, it's likely you might find something that nobody else has seen.
Right.
It becomes A, special to you, and B, something you get to share.
But I think
it's something you get to champion, which I think is a big part of what we do as critics.
I think that I agree to that to a point. I think if you're going to be a professional critic, you do have some responsibility to go through some of them.
I was talking about just personally.
And I'm making a distinction between the two.
Okay.
I think if you really want to do this professionally, or if you decide, or if you want to teach, or whatever, if you're just super duper passionate about it and you want to go that next extra step, then yes, you have a certain responsibility. You might never get to all of them, but to start working your way through the building blocks of cinema. There are certain films which are incredibly influential, incredibly important, incredibly referenced. Certain filmmakers you should be at least somewhat familiar with. There's that to it. Not everyone has that responsibility. You don't have to do that if you don't want to. But if you do, you should. Otherwise, you end up with a list of the 100 greatest films of all time from Empire.
Oh, God.
And only 12 of them are from before the 1970s.
Yeah, that's just...
Oh my God, did you see this thing?
Yes, I did. Empire Magazine put out a list of the 100 greatest films of all time.
Yes, that was the title.
It was just the 100 greatest films, period.
Yeah.
And not qualified by, and these were our criteria. No, this was according to the Empire staff or whoever wrote this list.
And they also listened to their readers or listeners.
Oh, they pulled that
in. Which is important, I think, here.
Yeah.
Because so we're going to end up with the films that a lot of people grew up with or saw because they're mainstream, and you're not going to end up with films that were selected by people who actually know all there is to know about it, or at least as much as they can.
So the original, the number one film on that list, which I was embarrassed to have guessed, was Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
The first of the Lord of the Rings movies.
Yeah.
That is the Peter Jackson film, not the animated film.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it have been keen if it were the Ralph Bakshi film?
That would have been a twist. That would have been a great twist. But
I was going through this list, and it's a lot of the. I'll just say it's a certain type of film. It's a certain type of film that is highly celebrated, widely known, and appeals to, broadly speaking, a young white male audience.
Yeah, there's a lot of action movies, not a lot of comedies, not a lot of straight dramas, and again, most of them.
Films you could watch as a teen,
I think about 25 of the films on the 100 film list, 25% of the list, was from the 2000s. From the last 20 years. Now, I personally feel that when we do these greatest movies of all time lists, that we
should update them.
I think we should update them. Yeah. And I think we don't cycle new movies into that 100 greatest of all time canon often enough. And I think there's certainly at least 10 or 12 films from 2000 onward, bare minimum, that you can make a good argument deserve to be on a list of the greatest films of all time.
I remember when the 2012 Sight and Sound poll, next one's coming up next year, by the way.
Oh, God.
We haven't been invited yet.
Not yet! Who knows somebody? Who knows someone in Sight and Sound? For the love of God.
I'm in my 40s now, maybe in my 50s. At the 2012 poll, they had an issue with that. That a lot of the films that were on the list were all incredibly old, and the number of films from the previous decade was very, very small.
Yeah.
So they actually had to run a second poll that a lot of people did participate in of what were the best films of the last decade.
Yeah, and I appreciate that if they're relatively recent and you might feel it's too early to canonize them because have they withstood what we might call the test of time.
Sit with them for a little bit.
That's fair.
Uh-huh.
But I also believe that if you're watching movies avidly and if you can't think of at least a couple of movies that came out in the last 10 years that you were so passionate about that you think they deserve to be considered at least in the top 100, I worry about the state of cinema if that's the case. But I can think of at least a few.
Yeah.
You know, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Mad Max Fury Road, A Separation,
Lighthouse, The White Ribbon.
Those are your picks, not mine, but perfectly reasonable picks. There's no shortage. But what we saw instead was this weird thing on that list. And again, it's someone else's list. It's all subjective. But we're also allowed to have a subjective opinion about the list and throw up a little in our mouths when we read it. So when I saw that like Citizen Kane was on it, I was like, oh, I actually wasn't expecting this. And it's at number 40 or 41. And I'm like, okay, that's a little low. What comes after Citizen Kane? The next one, Gladiator.
Oh, God. Really
right after Citizen Kane. And I'm like, again, I don't want to be too snobbish about this, but I think Citizen Kane is a more interesting film than Gladiator, and I happen to like Gladiator just fine. I wouldn't put it in my top 1,000 movies, but I like it fine. It's a good film for what it is.
I will be snobbish about Gladiator, because I don't like Gladiator, not one bit, and this is the list we're dealing with, where mm-hmm. Gladiator is slightly better than Citizen Kane.
Uh-huh.
This is the world we live in.
Yeah.
There's
no silent movies.
Yeah, no,
nothing from this. Nothing from the 30s. Only I think two movies from the 40s. Citizen Kane, Casablanca, and It's a Wonderful Life. That's it. Best Years of Our Lives.
Mm. Nothing from the 30s. No Quiet on the Western Front. No Nosferatu.
No Frankenstein. Yeah, no Metropolis. No The General.
And
no The Great Train Robbery. No Trip to the Moon.
These are things that these titles you're just sort of rattling off. These are like obvious things. Anybody who's just interested in movies kind of knows about.
Or at least has heard about them if you've done like a little research into the silent era, you know? Like if you've seen a documentary about the silent era.
And I think a lot of that stems from fandom.
Sure. There's a lot of recency bias as well, and I get that, but...
So, in conclusion, certainly don't go to that top 100 list when you're trying to fill in that fear, that sense of FOMO that you're clearly getting when you're trying to consume everything.
That type of list does not exist to raise your awareness of the greatest movies ever made. That type of list exists to make you feel better for not having watched a lot of films. I want you to feel okay for not having watched a lot of films. You've seen whatever you've seen at this point. If you want to watch a lot more, you will. If you don't, you won't, and that's fine too. All right? I bring that list up because I'm still mad about it, but it's fine. It's not my business. It's totally fine. Mm. I should move on. But anyway, thank you for writing in. We should move on. We're very loquacious today.
Oh, it's fine. You know what? This is...
I do like getting to more letters, though.
Yeah, this is a shorter week, so we can be loquacious on this particular podcast. Here's a letter from David Ellis. Hello, David.
Hey.
Dear Captain Seibold and Commander Bibiani,
mm.
I outrank you. I am a fan of your podcast network.
Thank you.
Your shows are great. Apologies in advance for the length of this email. Okay. Push off.
Never apologize. You're fine.
I'm listening to the most this is about Prodigy, by the way. I'm listening to the most recent We've Got Mail, and I found I disagreed strongly with the letter of the writer who ranted about Star Trek Prodigy, although I did like his designations for the two of you. Anyway, I don't think the show is talking down to kids at all. It seems to be in a similar vein to a show like Avatar The Last Airbender, which shows children being children but also growing up and grappling with the fact that they're basically collateral damage in adults' conflicts. The main characters, as stated in the WGM episode, are children raised in slavery, which is already a heady subject, even if the series isn't sugarcoating. Excuse me, stumbling a little bit.
It's okay.
The further the series gets away from the premiere episode, the more it shows that the young child characters are heavily traumatized in ways that they are only starting to grapple with. Small touches like Rock Talk only replicating food she ate in the mines because she's not used to what anything tastes like, or more overt ones like her railing against Gwyn for not doing anything to stop the way they were treated. It's an action show, sure, but also showing traumatized young people discovering what freedom is like for the first time. And that freedom is represented in the Protostar and the Federation, although they still have a lot to learn as well as a lot to unlearn.
Hmm.
Regarding the choice to focus almost entirely on a non-Federation cast of children, I think that's interesting. Sure, they can rely on kids getting into shows that their parents watch, and that's fine, but it's also a franchise that has, for the most part, been actively hostile to child characters or just flat-out didn't know what to do with them.
True.
I got that sense even as a kid getting into The Next Generation.
Yeah.
Even as they had a teenager on the Enterprise who was involved in brainstorming and the solving of some problems, I always got the sense that he was on the ship, and didn't want to or need to be there. It got better on Deep Space Nine with Nog and Jake, admittedly, but the problem remained that the writers didn't seem to know how to write children. Aspiring to be adult characters is one thing, but watching episodes of TNG and watching Have the Writers Ever Met Any Children My Age Ever was still off-putting.
Hmm.
Also, there's the interesting question of, what does the Star Trek concept look like to someone who's seeing it for the first time? Sadly, the Star Trek series has been historically poor about what life in the Trek universe looks like to people who aren't on a starship.
True.
Usually when we see Earth in Star Trek, it's a different time period or a simulation. One might look at the way the Federation civilians are dressed and give them the impression that the costume designers have no idea how someone lives in the 24th century. Some of the civilian clothes on Deep Space Nine are just
pretty bad.
Ugly.
Yeah.
The most extended look at day-to-day Federation society might actually be the recent Star Trek Picard series. So here's a chance to show what Federation space looks like from an outsider's point of view. And finally, regarding to the ongoing comparisons to Star Wars in Prodigy, I think that's mostly a result of being a CGI sci-fi show in a landscape that has been dominated by CGI Star Wars shows for over a decade now. Prodigy using the style of character design that favors alien body types over gluing prosthetics to human actors, so of course it's going to look more like Star Wars. And most of what we think the Star Trek aesthetic is just Starfleet, so starting outside that aesthetic and moving towards Starfleet is going to invoke some comparisons. I do think the Protostar looks like an amazing, sleek Federation ship. The Protostar is a cool-looking show. Look up a picture of the Protostar.
I will do that just now.
USS Protostar. And a great way to introduce that aesthetic to an outsider's point of view. Hopefully the series continues long enough and the main characters will no longer be outsiders to the Federation. Sincerely, David L.S.
Well, I'll say this right now. I haven't watched this one yet. But I do think it's two things are fair to say about the email that we just read. One, it's always exciting when people see something in a show that we don't like that is genuinely like inspiring and interesting and gets them excited about it.
Yeah.
So that's good, and maybe one or both of us will come around to that. The other thing is, I actually do agree that like we've never really had stories about kids in Star Trek.
And not many good ones, that's for sure.
That's true. Well, certainly not with any sort of regularity, except for, you know, the Wesley and the kids on Deep Space Nine, but they were never really about them. They were always side quests. Wanting to see different angles of Star Trek is a good idea. The one danger of that is that Star Trek does have a clear Starfleet identity. Star Trek isn't just the stories of this universe. Star Trek is the stories of Starfleet in this universe. And the further you move away from that, the less you're going to have that grounding of the sort of principles of Star Trek, which Federation is supposed to represent. So that could be dangerous if you go too far in that direction, but I can only say that academically. I'm looking at the Protostar now. It looks fine.
Yeah. The body of the ship opens up. It's actually like a third engine, and it can go faster than any other ship.
That's
sort
of fun.
That's the twist with the Protostar.
I can work with that.
I think the reason why Star Trek has struggled with child characters is because it's a show that vaunts maturity as a virtue.
Yeah.
It's about being cool-headed and collected and
it's about being
experienced.
Professional.
Yeah, about and those are
and having a job.
And it's a very vocational. It's a very adult world that Star Trek takes place in. And kids just don't have a place in that world, unless there's someone like Wesley who aspires to be part of it and is just too young to enter yet.
So they engineered a concept here where these kids end up taking over a Starfleet vessel.
Yes.
Done. Right? Well, I mean, at least on paper, that sounds like a good idea.
They have access to it, but they don't know kind of what it is, and they're sort of grappling with the idea of using it responsibly.
Yeah.
Now they have access to this ship. They can go anywhere. But they're not exploring. They're not getting as far away as they possibly can. The bad guys are still on their tail. And so far, like the mom figure, who's actually Captain Janeway in hologram form, is the one who's guiding them.
Right.
Like trying to make sure they do the mature thing. And I like those little elements, but it hasn't grown on me yet. These characters... I don't like the design of the characters. Yeah. Not that they look too weird for Star Trek. I think it's fine that they're going way out of their way. In fact, one of the characters is a Medusan, who we saw is in there in Truth No Beauty.
Oh.
The species that was like in a box. They're incomprehensible for the human mind.
That's cool.
They're like bound up in a ball and they have a little speaker and like tentacles so they can like walk around and interact.
That's really
and
cool.
Stuff. Yeah, so that's
okay.
That's a
and continuity
sure, that's
too. That's fun.
It's in continuity.
Yeah.
It's a fine idea.
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily have to be a ball. This is something they did in Babylon 5 as well. One of the characters is in this sort of like human-shaped suit.
Okay.
I forgot that character's name.
I never saw Babylon 5.
It's like an ambassador. It's like this big camera thing for a head, and it can take the shell off.
Well,
but
regardless, I just feel like the other thing I wanted to say.
But, let me finish my thought.
Finish your thought.
I forgot what I was going to say now.
You were talking about, you're okay with the designs.
I'm okay with the designs. I don't see... the Star Trek concept here, it's so far very action-based. And this notion that these are, like, young, scrappy, trauma-suffering children, forgive me, that's a dull concept now. Trauma has, I understand why trauma is being openly explored in so much of our pop media right now, because the people making it were kids when 9/11 happened in the United States. And I think a lot of that
trauma
is
not unique to 9/11. A lot of people are traumatized their whole damn lives.
No, but I think that there's a reason why it's concentrated right now. And around the certain age of creators who are making it. These things do echo on one another. And I'm not blaming it all on 9/11, but there's a lot of trauma that the millennial generation has gone through. And I think that's what's sort of arising in pop media right now.
I also think that
so much so that it can be a little tiresome after a while. It feels like an easy fallback.
Well, I will say this right now. You're describing the way that a lot of media, not just Star Trek, is starting to deal very directly with trauma. Entire generations are starting to deal openly with trauma. Trauma and generational trauma, trauma passed down from one generation to another, like within a family, for example, is a real, tangible, ongoing psychological problem that we are not... We've only really just begun to start, A, talking about in earnest, and B, destigmatizing, so that we can talk about this. Instead of just saying, oh, that's old Crazy Eddie, he went to NAMM, and now he's weird. It's like, no, that guy is actually suffering, and there's a certain sensitivity to what trauma does to people now. When I think about how in The Next Generation, the character of Tasha Yar, we find out that she's from a planet where things were really, really terrible. She doesn't really talk about it in great detail, but she does talk about how there were gangs of people who would just wander around and they would be assaulting people in horrible ways. That's a dystopian thing. That's a dystopian concept. That is not a Star Trek concept. That's someone who was saved from something horrible. I feel like if that show were released today with the exact same characters, by the time Tasha Yar left the show, within season one, we probably would have had at least one episode dealing with how horrible that is and how that shaped her as a character, you know? Like, we're not really doing that. So I think being able to talk openly about this is exciting for a generation that is used to media that does not. And if I think it's something that I think I see a lot of and I actually appreciate when it's done well, because me not being able to deal with the various traumas that I've gone through has had a really negative impact on my life. And I feel like if I had seen it dealt with more openly in the media, I would have felt more like I could have sought help earlier. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's a good thing in children's program. I think Avatar The Last Airbender did that really well. So I appreciate that there's a lot of it right now, and that maybe it seems like it's starting to echo a bit much. But I do overall see that as a good thing.
Overall,
so that's my counterpoint.
Overall, perhaps, but how long are we exploring this before it loses that sensitivity and it becomes a plot point?
That's a danger.
That's
a danger, but I'd rather can we explore it first and then let that happen?
I suppose so. I feel like...
I'd rather have it than not.
I simply, maybe it's because of the volume of media I consume, but I see it a lot to the point where I feel like we're at that tipping point, where we need to either deal with it sensitively or maybe... don't use it just sort of as this cheap backup.
To back up
a low quality product and try to make it sound profound.
No,
I feel the same way about
it done well.
There's an entire Law and Order series devoted to sexual assault.
There is.
To the point where a lot of people I know who are actually sufferers and victims find it to be cheap and risible.
Yeah.
It's not a sensitive exploration of
formulaic,
the people.
Yeah, it's repetitious.
Exactly,
thing.
it becomes almost weird.
But that's one show, and again, if we're talking in cycles, Law and Order isn't one storyline over all those episodes. It's a new story every single week. Sometimes more than one.
Yes,
so you're going to get that cycle a lot faster.
I understand, but and this is coming from some of my friends. They watched it as sort of a comedy show about how they tried to look really sensitive and important when really they were lousing up a lot of the details.
Yeah.
They weren't dealing with things sensitively. It was only considered sensitive for people who were casually watching the show or making dinner while Law and Order
people
was on.
People who never really go out of their way to look for material like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's kind of what's happening with intergenerational trauma right now. It's explored maybe a little bit too deeply.
Oh,
that's the way I feel. And again, this is...
I know too many people who refuse to believe it exists.
Oh, well.
Regardless...
Again, this,
I can
this
appreciate...
likely stems from the volume that I consume. Seeing it a lot. Maybe
because
I'm a critic, I'm seeing it more often than...
And not necessarily every single thing you're watching is doing it well. whereas you might actually, yeah, depending on your taste, only be encountering it well. Regardless, I see the attempt to deal with it as better than ignoring it, which is what's been done too much. But anyway, we should move on because
I apologize
we're
for being a little cynical about it.
No, no, I get it. You're looking at it. You're looking at it from just a sort of a volume rather than quantity versus quality.
Yeah,
I'm more concerned that there's quality now, finally. That I'm willing to forgive that there's maybe more than I need.
No, but my concern is that the quantity will outstrip the quality at some point.
I would rather have it and run that risk than not. Okay. But let's move on.
Here's a letter from Mason.
Hey, Mason.
Dear Mr. W the First and Mr. W the Second, I've been listening...
I'm the second. I'm youngest.
Sure. I've been listening to you guys' stuff since finding Cancel Too Soon partway through 2017, and your wit, rapport, and passion for the art of cinema has been a welcome addition to my life ever since.
Thank you.
I'm currently in my last year of undergrad, fingers crossed, and taking classes for my film and media studies minor that I'm not going to be able to finish on the history of animation and experimental film. Through this class, I got to see The Man with a Movie Camera, the Quay Brothers' Street of Crocodiles,
I think
Neighbors.
The Quay Brothers, isn't it?
Quay?
Oh, whatever, anyway.
I think Key Brothers, Street of Crocodiles, Neighbors, and A Cherry Tale from Norman McLaren and Kenneth Anger's Custom Car Commandos.
Nice.
I also known as the best fucking thing I've ever seen in my entire life. Custom Car Commandos, all spelled with K's. A few weeks ago, our professors asked for suggestions for films that addressed contemporary issues facing marginalized peoples. So I suggested Mary and Max. It's an Australian stop-motion dramedy about a profoundly lonely grade school girl in Melbourne, Mary, who becomes pen pals with a profoundly lonely middle-aged man in New York, Max, and their two-decade correspondence. Halfway through the movie, Max is diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, which creates a rift in their friendship when Mary writes a book about the disorder using Max as a case study. It's one of my favorite movies, and getting to watch the two scenes from it in class are the highlights of my semester so far.
Aww.
It's also easily the best portrayal of autism I've seen in any film or TV show, at least in my experience. Max is never the object of pity, nor is his existence used as a device for Mary to learn a valuable lesson about selflessness or some hackneyed cloying bullshit. There's even a moment when he states that curing his autism would be like, I'm trying to change the color of my eyes. Being autistic myself, I'm morbidly fascinated with badly written autistic characters. It's as if most people writing this stuff have heard of autism but don't really understand it, so they write autistic people like these strange fairy folk that sometimes vaguely behave like actual people or as, quote, more evolved versions of humanity, both of which are equally condescending. It doesn't usually offend me, but it's baffling how misguided some of these portrayals are. I'm almost impressed by it. What are some of your guys' favorite and least favorite portrayals of autistic characters? I'll accept both characters who are confirmed in text to be on the spectrum and characters who read to you as such. I hope this message finds you okay. From your friendly neighborhood masshole, good luck and Godspeed, Mason. P.S. If you can weigh in on Custom Car Commandos, it would make my day.
Whitney's, I'm trying to remember if I've seen this one. I think you've definitely seen this one, obviously.
I saw a collection of Kenneth Anger shorts. Yeah. Back in my 20s. So same. I think that is one I saw, but okay. I can't call
it's been
details
a while.
To mind.
It's been a while, but obviously we're Kenneth Anger fans. We did a whole episode about Scorpio Rising. When it comes to artistic representation, I believe it's incredibly important. I also believe that as someone who is not autistic, I should stay in my lane a bit here.
Yeah.
And I don't want to go... We've talked about representation a lot on this show. A lot of people have written in asking us and our readers for good examples and sometimes bad examples of representation in cinema. And I, because of my lack of personal experience, I've known autistic people, I've known a lot of autistic people, but I still don't feel like I can comfortably say what is fair and accurate. What I will recommend is a really excellent video essay that actually I just watched with my partner in Lapis da Silva from a YouTuber named Jesse Gender. J-E-S-S-I-E-G-E-N-D-E-R.
Okay.
It's called Sia's Music, The Trap of Symbolic Autistic Representation.
Okay.
Which is all about the movie that pop star Sia made about a year ago.
Sia.
I heard it was Sia.
It's pronounced Sia.
I could have sworn I just heard her on the radio saying, hi, this is Sia.
Really? Oh,
I could be wrong. Well, regardless, Sia or Sia. I don't know pop music. I'm just going to say right now.
However you pronounce her name.
It's spelled S-I-A.
Her film music was widely derided for its inaccurate portrayal of autism.
Yes, lots of inaccurate portrayal of autism here, but it led to a really fascinating conversation about exactly the way that film failed to be a proper representation and how certain other films have, including a film that is kind of about Star Trek. So that's a really, really good essay. It's about 45 minutes long. It's on YouTube. It's totally free, obviously. Mm. It's called Sia or Sia's Music, The Trap of Symbolic Autistic Representation. Mm. It's a great starting point for this. Yeah. Obviously, there's no end. But it's a great starting point if you want to like hear some really thoughtful stuff about people who actually really know what they're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great place to start.
I do know... I mean, I can point to plenty of bad examples.
Sure.
Finding good examples is the difficult thing.
Yeah.
It always does bother me when a TV show or a film will think to include a character on the spectrum. And I think, oh, good, we're going to have somebody who put a lot of thought and energy into this. Mm-hmm. We're going to explore, we're going to go into Star Trek with a character on the spectrum mm-hmm. and see what Starfleet looks like to a character on the spectrum.
Yeah.
We're going to see it from their perspective. We're going to see how Star Trek mm-hmm. interacts with a character like that.
Yeah.
And they kind of forget about that immediately. And, yeah. You know, the next, you know, there's no other indicators that they're yeah. on the spectrum well,
and
all throughout the rest of the show.
And indeed, Jesse Gender's video mm. actually talks about how there are certain characters in Star Trek, mm. specifically Mr. Spock and Data, mm. who have been actually appreciated by many people in the autistic community for kind of accidentally,
mm.
because they have an alien experience, because they're dealing with human emotion and human interactivity mm. From kind of the outside looking in, those characters have been appreciated a lot, even though those were accidental representation.
Something I've always liked about Star Trek is they yeah. try to offer new perspectives on humanity as a whole.
Yeah.
Through the, you know, the science fiction perspective, but still we get a new perspective.
Yeah. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to. We've thrown this out there mm. a lot lately.
Yeah, keep throwing them back
again.
At us.
I feel like we've asked had this request before for good examples of autistic representation. I'd like to focus on the good, but if there's any negative ones that maybe aren't as well talked about, or maybe so accepted that we aren't really talking about them enough as being negative, feel free to write in. And we're looking particularly for people who really know what they're talking about.
Mm.
So once again, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net, and our P.O. box is...
P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Right. We'd love to hear from you because, again, we love cinema, we love talking about this stuff, but it's important sometimes to know this is not our lane. So, we yield the highway.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get to the next letter.
Yeah.
Here is a letter from Sam. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Sam.
Dear the Luca Show, with special guest William Bibbiani and musical guest Rockmeister McCool. That's me, Rockmeister McCool. Yeah. Where is Luca?
Luca's napping on the bed.
Luca's the cat.
Luca has been a little bit more active the last couple of weeks. I think people probably heard him more often than lately.
I think it was the last episode we recorded was Luca was so active. Like, Luca was literally climbing up the door.
Yeah.
And we had to pause the show. It's rare that Luca is so disruptive that we just stopped the show entirely.
When he was a kitten, he was very, very active. And now he's like an adult cat. And he's mellowed a smidge. But anyway.
Here's a letter that actually... oh, wait. I said Sam. Okay, here's a letter from Sam.
Yeah, it's for Luca.
Do the Luca Show. Since I started listening to your podcast a few years ago, I started to watch more horror movies.
Hmm.
I don't like being scared, but luckily I'm not scared by most movies. I just don't like jump scares. Despite this, I've still enjoyed a lot of the movies I've seen, and I've noticed that some of the people who say a horror movie is bad because it's not scary. So this leads me to my question. Do you think a horror movie needs to be scary to be good? Also, I'd suggest the 2018 anime that's a Dadaist satire of anime and pop culture called Pop Team Epic for the next Cancel Too Soon anime month. It's weird, short, and entirely on Crunchyroll. Your former and future Alien Prince Tears patron, Sam.
Thank you, Sam. I feel like I might have seen some of Pop Team Epic, but I might be confused in the name of something. I'll look into it. But that's a good question.
Good question.
Something that I've heard a lot. Do horror movies need to be scary to be good? I have a very firm take on this, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
I'm just gonna definitively say they don't need to frighten you,
mm-hmm.
but they should fill you with doubt. They should fill you with dread. A good horror movie, I mean, if a movie kind of has a lot of jump scares in it and the The It movie is a good example of this. The Conjuring movies are good. There's a lot of banging
Evil
noises.
Evil Dead 1 and 2.
Monsters lurching out of the darkness and scaring you. There's a fun to that. There's a carnival kind of atmosphere in a theater when you're seeing a good scary movie with a lot of jump scares in it. And it's fun to be scared in that capacity, I think, especially where in a safety of a theater surrounded by a crowd and everybody's screaming.
It's like
and
a roller coaster.
Noise. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But to be a good horror movie, you don't necessarily need those qualities. It's not necessarily a bad thing. But all you need is some good or interesting way to talk about fear, dread, doubt, and death. Those are the four corners. Fear, dread, doubt, and death.
If only you could come up with some sort of D word that means being scared. Dread, doubt, and death.
Terrified.
I'm going to look up synonyms. I'm a little distracted.
Fear, dread, doubt, and death are the things that sort of create the most anxiety in humanity.
These are sort of the
despair. There's another D word for you.
Distress. Distress, doubt, dread, and distress. Dread, doubt, and fear.
There you go.
That's not bad.
The four Ds.
Yeah.
We just coined a thing. Write those down.
I'm writing it down. This is copyright.
you and I had a conversation once a while back about what the difference between a horror movie and a thriller is. And horror movies are about death, whereas thrillers are about survival. It's about what you need to do to survive. And it's sort of about the actions you take. It's about rising up and surviving. Distress or doom?
Doom is simpler, and it deals more with impending
doom, death. Yeah, all right.
Okay, because that way everything's got one
fear,
syllable.
Fear and doom, sure.
Yeah, well, because dread's kind of fear. So you got doom, dread, doubt, and death.
Okay.
Those are the four Ds. A good horror movie should deal with at least some of the four Ds.
Do those things need to frighten you? Maybe they should shake you a little bit. I think the better horror movies are going to be very intelligent and maybe even a little bit dark about the way they address those concepts within your soul. Mm-hmm. They're making you face the thing that you're afraid of. And if you leave a little bit unnerved, that's going to be a lot more powerful than if a scary clown jumped out and made you jump in your seat a little bit. Mm.
But not every film's going for that.
So do horror films need to be scary? They don't need to frighten you, but if they're going to be good, I think they do need to at least have you leaving the theater thinking about sort of your deepest fears and why you might be afraid of them.
My take on it is this. I'm a big fan of genre studies.
Yeah.
And the way that one film does something well, and then all of a sudden people realize, oh, here there are specific parameters we can follow to successfully do something similar.
Yeah.
And gradually we build a genre on top of that. And that's true for movies, music, comics, books, whatever.
All art,
basically. However, I do believe that when you are categorizing a genre or your subgenre, quality cannot be part of the criteria. Because quality is subjective. There need to be quantifiable. You can be able to put them on a list, things that people don't like the movie can see. Criteria, reasons to categorize a movie as whatever the genre is. Horror, romantic comedy, family, post-apocalyptic, doesn't matter. And I actually think Whitney's pretty close to my point of view here. I think that a horror movie, regardless of what it does with it, because there are many funny horror movies, and they're supposed to be funny, they're not supposed to fill you with dread. There are many horror movies that are more about giving you just sort of a general sense of unease, like anything could happen at any time. And there's something to be said for cultivating that jump scare mentality if it's done well. But doing it well cannot be the criteria.
If an
action movie is still an action movie if it doesn't make your pulse pound. All right, you can be a lot of boring action movies, but are there car chases? Does the story revolve around life or death set pieces and fights? That's an action movie.
That's what we're talking about. Can still bore you.
Exactly. So a horror movie doesn't have to be scary, and there's a million different ways to be scary. There's sort of insidious, gets under your skin. There's just like, I feel a little nervous walking home tonight and then in front of all these dark alleys kind of thing. Mm. And then there's, that clown killed a lot of people. And they're like, you're sort of fine with it at the end. All of those things are fine, but fear is a subjective emotion. What scares you might not be what scares everybody else. a lot of people are scared by, for example, The Exorcist. It scared the shit out of a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Just because it doesn't scare you doesn't mean it's not a good horror movie. The Exorcist still deals with a lot of distressing topics. It deals in demonology. It deals in the devil. It deals in children in peril. It deals with the fear of what happens when your child is ill and you don't know why and no one can tell you. It deals with the existential terror of questioning your faith, or what happens when your faith is suddenly affirmed and you didn't want it to be. It deals with all of these things, and we can recognize those things and we can see those things. So even if The Exorcist isn't scary to you, I think it's still possible to say it's a good horror movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's dealing with all these things in an interesting way. And you can do that in a funny way. You can do that in a shocking way. So, no, I don't think it's necessary. But I do believe that the ones that do manage to scare you do tend to stick out. And as a result, we often favor those. And we say, that movie scared the shit out of me. That's the scariest movie of all time. And you might want to call that the best horror movie ever made to you.
Yeah.
But that, again, that's purely subjective. That doesn't necessarily have to be for everyone.
When I was in high school and I had just seen the movie and it made me scream, which is something that movies didn't do a lot when I was a teenager, was Wes Craven's New Nightmare.
Yeah.
And there's a, not only does it have these weird existential philosophies in it, but there's some really good jump scares in that movie as well.
What was the last movie that made you scream?
It's been a while since I've, like, screamed out loud in a movie theater.
I would say there was the last one that got me to go, ah!
Uh-huh.
Was actually, and I don't even like the movie very much, but it got me for one moment, was actually It Chapter 2. There's a scene where there's a kid in a park, and we're kind of close-up shot of the kid, and then right next to this kid is this giant evil lumberjack statue.
Uh-huh.
And it was so completely out of left field, and so weird, and I was so not expecting that shot at all, that it actually, like, ah! What the fuck? And it was the only one. It was the only one, but it totally weirded me out.
There was a shot in Inland Empire, which is kind of a nightmare of a movie anyway. It's kind of difficult to wrap your head around because it's 3 hours of, like, seemingly unconnected vignettes.
Yeah.
But there's a scene where the Laura Dern character is having, like, sort of this nightmarish vision of herself. And we see this, like, sort of exaggerated version of her face. And it's just a still photograph. And the camera, the lights slowly fade up on it, so it kind of, like, fades into existence. Yeah. And it's a big kind of... Look it up on the online. It's really
it's a commonly used still from the film, actually.
Yeah, it's really scary looking. And I was, like, staring at it for a minute, and it got sort of this reaction. It's like...
David Lynch knows how to
scream. It's like a slow moving scream.
He knows how to take a moment that in a vacuum may or may not be scary and present it in such a way that it is fucking terrifying. Like, he just knows that. He's like the scene in the Mulholland Drive behind the Winkies.
Oh yeah, that monster thing. Like,
what's actually happening in that scene? Not a lot.
Who are those characters? We don't see them
again. I just had this horrible dream, but there was a thing behind the Winkies, and they go behind the Winkies, and there's a thing there. That's nothing. The delivery, the performance. Is it David Dasmalchian who's in that? Who's like the main guy in that scene?
I forgot the actor's name.
Whatever. I'll look it up in a second. But like his delivery combined with the very slow camera work, the very deliberate, the sound design. The
sound design especially.
That is one of the scariest scenes in movie history. Period. You can see it in a vacuum. You can see it in the context of the film. It is terrifying. It's all in the delivery. Not a lot's actually happening. But it's about his fear. It is about his terror.
How afraid he is,
And everything about that scene sells it. So, anyway. So to answer your question, it's a little complicated, but no, you don't have to be genuinely scary to be a good horror movie, because what scares us is subjective and different from person to person, but we can be able to recognize a good horror movie even if it doesn't scare us, specifically because we can't expect every single thing to scare us, even if it's well done.
I admit I'm an easy mark when it comes to horror. I'm not skittish. I don't get jump scares a lot. Usually if it's a jump scare happens, just like take another shot and go, ah, ha, ha, that's a good one. Oh, look, you can see his spine. You know, I'm pretty jaded in certain regards.
Look at me.
But when it comes to like films that are about dread or really kind of like slow moving horror or some sort of mysterious thing that's lurking in the background and we can't talk about it or look at it, those things tend to get under my skin. That's just sort of the way I'm wired.
I'm always open to it. I think I never understood the mentality of some horror fans who are just like, oh, nothing scares me. Well, why are you watching at this point? Doesn't that seem like the whole point is to sort of access our fear?
A close friend of mine is that way. He's been watching horror movies since far too early an age. He's seeing like gory movies at age 6. And He's pretty jaded, and he doesn't go to horror movies to be scared. He finds them just to be like action movies, like thrilling entertainments.
My question for someone like that, and I don't want, even if I asked you and you knew the answer, I wouldn't trust it, because this should be something very deeply personal. But if that's the case, where like, oh, I see a lot of horror movies and nothing scares me anymore, my follow-up question is, what does scare you?
Yeah, what would scare
something's
you?
Got it. You know, we're all human. There's always got to be. It could be something that isn't in horror movies, like the thought of dying alone, you know, confronting my parents about something bad that happened.
One of the scariest movies you ever saw was Michael Haneke's Amour.
Yeah, that movie scares the shit out of me. Yeah,
because that's about end-of-life care.
Yeah, that movie terrifies me. To this day, thinking about that movie scares me. It's not strictly speaking a horror movie. But I think it hits the right moments. Yeah, I think it technically counts.
As Michael Haneke films go, it's actually incredibly humane.
Oh, super humane. It's very sensitive. But that's one of the reasons why it hit me so hard, was its lack of cynicism. I mean, I would argue the ending gets a little cynical, but it's still very, very sympathetic.
Yeah.
And that's a movie that just makes me scared to get older.
Mm-hmm.
Like, scared to. Mm. Yeah. I think we have time for one more.
Okay, here's a letter from James, and this goes back to something we were saying earlier.
Mm.
Hey, Bibbs and Rockmeister, me cool. A lot of E's, a lot of O's.
Got it.
I've been a long-time Patreon member, and I have been so for several years now. Love you guys talking about movies, even the more obscure ones, because it reminds me that there are so many movies that I would never consider, and you remind me that there are gems that I still need to know about. I miss the two-shot, and hope you can bring up a version of that back in some way someday. Someday.
Maybe,
someday.
We have a lot of stuff we're doing now. We have a lot of stuff we're doing now. We have a lot of ideas we'd like to get to, but we also need to figure out the best way to do them, because we're overworked as is, and we really would love to be more productive.
Yeah, okay.
You have no idea how much we'd love to be more productive.
I wish there were twice as many hours in the day.
Oh, my God.
Now, having said that, I do have to, take exception and also ask a question about critics and the whole industry of film criticism.
Okay.
In particular, Ghostbusters Afterlife sits at 61% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay.
Where the general audience, at least on Rotten Tomatoes, has graded at around 95%. The general consensus from critics saying that nostalgia was overwrought, the callbacks were unnecessary or egregious, and that fan service is what destroyed the movie. Also hearing Whitney's take that it should have never been made is something that I take exception to, and it's too simplistic of a view of why it was ever made.
I thought that was a little harsh, to be frank, but that was your call.
That's the voice I took, and that's what I got to stand by. I'm around the same age as you guys. I grew up watching Ghostbusters, and I thought the first half of the movie was something new and unique, and the second half was a continuation of a story that happened from the first movie, and it all makes sense because I feel like it was a movie dedicated to Harold Ramis, the first movie, and our love for it. I loved the movie, because in the end, it closed the loop on the first Ghostbusters, and now we can continue on with a newer cast.
Okay.
Which brings me to wanting to ask, are critics down on this film and the same of its ilk because they watch so many? This goes back to my comments on sort of the overuse of certain themes. I'll just ask because I feel like in general, critics see so many movies that they are just looking for something that is so different from the things that they see that they bring a movie down like Ghostbusters because they feel like it is just fluff and derivative. I have kids who are 10 and 12 and they loved it.
Okay.
I was someone who loved the first Ghostbusters and it did what I wanted it to do. There were lots of cheers in the theater I saw it in. I'm not saying that what you guys said about the movie is not valid, but I'm wondering if, in general, are you two watching so much that something that is not out of the ordinary will not at least give something like Ghostbusters a fair shake? I'm not saying that it was an awesome movie. I think it was definitely something Ghostbusters fans wanted to see, and now I feel like other sequels can tread new ground. So sorry for the long-winded email. I'm so thankful for you guys and your opinion. Thank you for taking the time to read this, James in the Bay.
James, thank you so much for writing in. These are valid questions that people talk about all the time. I feel sometimes the conversation about them is driven by people who don't actually understand how the film critic job works. So let me get started on this. First off, to your second big point, which is that critics see more movies than a typical moviegoer because we make the time. Like it's our job, or it's our passion at least. And as a result, our standards can be raised a little high.
Yeah.
Yes, 100% true. That's a fact. That is, however, I would argue, a selling point and not a problem. I believe that when we go to a critic for their thoughts on a movie, if the critic doesn't have any more experience with the medium or any more deeper knowledge of the medium than we do, why are we reading that critic? Like, we want people to...
You want an expert, essentially.
Well, yeah, as much as one can be. And this is why, and again, no one is an expert on everything. We've had this conversation a lot, and we've got mail.
An expert, I'll just say someone with...
expertise.
Some expertise. So,
and again, your expertise in cinema can be in a million different fields. There's a lot of different ways to be an expert in cinema. You can be an expert in the history, a specific genre, a specific era. You should. I think every critic should have at least a general overview of film history. And that requires you to see a lot of movies that people... in the mainstream audience don't necessarily go out of their way to see and aren't necessarily thinking about as they watch a movie. And as a result, you'll get a bit more of a nuanced take from a professional critic, generally speaking. I think you should. I think it's the point.
Then you will
from a general audience member. And a general audience member who can write maybe a comment if they choose, or just click plus or minus on Rotten Tomatoes, whereas a critic... if they're going to give a review on Rotten Tomatoes, have to actually justify every single thing they think about that movie. Whether or not they do it well is another matter, but that is the gig. A critic is supposed to have high standards. And this goes for anything. If you go to a food critic and say, hey, what's the best hamburger in town? And they say McDonald's. That's either extremely damning about your town or a critic who hasn't eaten at enough restaurants.
Yeah.
And I think that's fair to say for cinema as well. If you ask, and we just talked about this in Empire, when we talked about the Empire list. I'm not saying every movie on that Empire list was bad, but what I am saying is that when you look at that list and you just see how narrowly focused that list of the greatest films of all time is, it makes you question just how much the people who wrote it actually know about the history of cinema and how many movies they've really seen. Because if you've seen a lot of them, you probably are going to have a bit more... nuanced take than anything that was popular in the last 20 years must be good. So, on that note, yes, that's true. That is oftentimes a bit of a dividing line between critics and audiences. I agree with that.
Let me reiterate the point, though, stemming from that
yeah,
it's not necessarily a critic's job to reflect popular opinion.
Oh, it's not their job at all to reflect popular opinion. That's not the gig.
It's our gig is to reflect our own opinion.
It'd be the easiest job in the world if it was. We just wait until the audience gives their audience score on Rotten Tomatoes
and then say that's it's my a score 90. Too. Yeah.
Yeah, that's useless. You don't need us for that. You don't need anyone for that.
Yeah, well,
you're not going to get any actual like insight or thought or understanding into it at all. You're just going to get cool, the audience likes it. The audience, by the way, this is why I don't trust the audience scores on Rotten Tomatoes. I wanted to get to this real fast.
Okay, yeah.
If a critic wants to put a score up on Rotten Tomatoes, they have to put up a review. The audience doesn't.
They can just click a button.
They don't even need to prove that they've seen it.
Who is clicking the button? A healthy cross section of everybody who's seen the movie?
Is everyone?
Or a certain person who has something to say?
Yeah, if someone's passionate about it, they're going to go out of their way. But think about how many people... there's a lot of people probably saw Ghostbusters and said, oh, I like that. Next time I'm on Rotten Tomatoes, I'll say I liked it. You can do that. That's totally fine.
There you go. There's an upvote.
But think about how many people who saw it and went, and never thought about it again, and as a result, never went to Rotten Tomatoes. Probably a fair percentage of the number of people who would see any movie. It's not as accurate as I would like it to be.
The Rotten Tomatoes, again... and this needs to be like reiterated time and time again, but how the way Rotten Tomatoes works, it is just an aggregate of how certain critics feel about it. 61% of critics who submitted reviews to Rotten Tomatoes gave it a pass.
Yeah, that's not a claim. That's not saying it's the greatest thing ever.
It's a thumbs up. That's all it is.
It means it's better than bad.
Yeah.
And if those are your two options around Tomatoes, you're better than bad or worse than good. Mm. That's it.
And the delineating line on Rotten Tomatoes is 60%, whether it's a tomato or a splat.
And just because, what did they say, they got 91% audience score?
95%.
95% audience score for Ghostbusters. Here's what that means. 95% of the people who wanted to see it so much that they paid a ticket for it decided to go back to Rotten Tomatoes and say... it was fine, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe they loved it, maybe they didn't, but that's all that means is that it's fine, I guess. They didn't regret buying their ticket. Yeah. That's a pretty low bar.
Here's something that's really frustrating, because this is not addressing our listener who wrote the letter. We're sort of like going to bigger ideas.
They brought up a big can of worms.
Yeah.
They brought up a big can of worms.
Yeah, but I don't want to sort of dismiss James' opinion in any of this, because James has some valid points, and if you enjoyed it, I'm not going to take that away from you. I want you to enjoy film. I want every film to be good,
yeah,
and I want people to enjoy movies. I happen to not like that movie for the reasons I stated.
Yeah, Whitney said some harsh things, but that's his opinion.
That's my opinion, and I do stand by those. I think these are big problems of the movie, and they rubbed me the wrong way, and yes, it's entirely possible that we as critics see so many movies that we're extra keyed into when things are derivative, because we've seen it in classic movies in the past, done much better in the past.
Well, we've seen more movies do it recently than someone who only sees a dozen movies a year.
This stems to my complaint about trauma being overused as a theme. Some people might not feel that. Maybe they're not seeing the same things I am. Maybe they're not seeing the theme repeated over and over again. So my complaint could be a little bit misguided, because it's just from my perspective.
And it always is.
And everything I say is going to be from my perspective. Where was I going with this? we see so many movies. What frustrates me is that, you know, we as critics, we see a lot of movies, we key into a lot of things that are repeated, and we often hear that when audiences who only see maybe like 15 to 20 movies a year, they want something familiar. And it frustrates me, because if you're only going to see 20 movies a year, surely you want them all to be different experiences, right?
Well, that's objective, right?
I suppose so. Yeah. Like, if you liked one thing, you want to go back and have a similar experience. There's, I get that.
Going
you go back to your favorite restaurant, you get a similar dish.
We want comfort. Yeah. That's a perfectly valid reason to go to an art form.
It's valid, but surely there are people who see 20 movies a year who do want 20 different experiences.
I believe that novelty is not inherently good any more than being derivative is inherently bad. It's all a matter of whether you do it well. And if we feel that they're doing it badly, I don't care if it's novel or repetitive, that's all there is to that.
Yeah.
If we find it repetitive to a fault, or nostalgic to a fault, that's a point to make. But again, it's subjective, and some people will be really satisfied with it. Because again, this is clearly a weaponized film. This film is specifically designed to poke fans of Ghostbusters and say, hey, you like this?
And
a lot of people will, because they're very reverential about it. I totally get it. I thought they went way harder than they needed to go, but I get it. I personally think that the idea that, okay, we wrapped up the story and we can move on, I thought we did that after the first two movies. We could have just moved on
That's another frustration.
We tried to move on, and people were like, we want the old one again. So we had to go back and then revisit something that we'd already moved on from.
And that's like modern franchise thinking, isn't it? It's like, well, we can't do it now. We'll do it in a future film. Do it now.
Why not?
Why do we have to wait for a future film? Close something and start something new? Just do it now.
I firmly believe that it, you know, maybe be a little clunky, but you could take the post-credit sequence from Ghostbusters Afterlife and have it be the first scene in the movie. And a new movie. And it would, no one would ever know that this story was missing. Mm. Ever. But anyway, we got to go because my computer is down to 2%.
Oh, well, darn. Okay.
Okay, so we're gonna wrap this up real fast. Sorry, we'd love to go on for like another hour about that, because that's totally our jam. But thank you, everybody, for writing in. If you would like to write into a future episode, once again, letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Special shout out to all of our patrons. We have a lot of exclusive shows on Patreon, including shows about Star Trek. That is patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We're on Twitter @criticacclaim. I am @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
We are currently having this weekend a Black Friday sale over at Salt Cat Soap, our Etsy store. You can find the link on social media, Salt Cat Soap on Facebook, Salt Cat Soap on Instagram, Salt Cat Soap on Twitter, or you can just go to Etsy and look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. All of our soaps are 10% off any order of $15 or more. It's a really good deal. We've had a lot of good feedback on it, and we hope you enjoy the soaps. There's some really cool stuff for the holidays. That is it. Thank you, everybody. We hope you're having a really nice, fun, safe holiday weekend. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney. Ooh, 1%.